Blog Talk Radio.
We're on air. Okay. I gotta get some headphones. I'll go to Best Buy and get some headphones. Learn how to connect.
This is Jason Ophir.
This is Sherry Penn.
And welcome to another episode of Paranormal Horizons, where we explore the world of
Bigfoot,
O-viewing,
UFOs,
demons,
and psychics.
Please stay tuned for this exciting episode. Greetings, everyone in Internet land. I'm Jason Ophir, and welcome to another episode of Paranormal Horizons here with our co-host, Sherry Pang. And Sherry has set up a great guest this evening. We're having Andrea Perron back, and so we're very excited about that. I know she's taken some special time for us this evening because she's really busy. But Sherry, how are you?
Good. How are you, Jason?
Not too bad. I got some vacation coming up from work in a week, so I'm kind of excited to do that. So I have something to look forward to. But as always, I look forward to doing another episode of Paranormal Horizons, and excited to get Andrea back. And, you know, we have the release of The Conjuring 2, which I think was related to a case in Europe, a very famous poltergeist thing. And, But yeah, it's really exciting to get her back on. And how are things going in your neck of the woods? Anything special going on?
Nothing special. I stayed home. It's too hot outside. I don't like the humidity, so I stayed at home. I stayed inside and did a couple readings, and that's pretty much about it. No, I was pretty spent. I did a 5-mile run yesterday, and it just kind of wiped me out, so...
I don't know how you do that. I don't even think I could walk 5 miles, let alone run 5 miles.
It keeps me halfway sane. That and teaching yoga and my other job. So I just enjoy it, really do. Okay, well, I'm excited to have Andrea. I know the whole hour is going to go by really, really fast. So I'd like to give her the floor as much time as possible, Jason.
Absolutely. We'll go ahead and we'll bring her on right now. Andrea, hello.
Hi, Jason. Hi, Sherry. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Oh, great. I had a long, long weekend, a big event in Tampa last night with PKC, Paranormal Kicks Cancer, which is a big fundraiser for childhood cancer. And we got home about, I don't know, midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, something like that. And then my sisters and two of their grandchildren came down to Orlando today, and we went to a theme park. And anybody that's interested, just go to my wall on Facebook, and I did a bunch of pictures, called my weekend in pictures, which pretty much encapsulates the whole thing, including some hysterical shot of my grown siblings acting like 5-year-olds. It was great. We had a blast.
Did you go to Universal?
Pictures.
No, we didn't go to one of the big parks because the kids, two of my father's 10 great-grandchildren are just too small to go on most of the rides and the amusements at the big parks. So we went to a smaller venue in Orlando, that caters to youngins, you know, the little ones. So, yeah, it was perfect. They didn't get turned away from anything. It was wonderful.
Orlando's fun. My uncle used to be an executive with Universal and went down there, and we got this his pass card. So we went to Universal or Orlando, we didn't have to wait in any lines, and it was everything was so quick, but everybody would look at you like, you know, because you're basically cutting in line.
You get looked like you're just the scum of the earth because
exactly.
You got ahead of them because you had a special. It's like how people in coach look at the people in first class, like, how dare you?
Exactly. So now the Conjuring 2, I don't know a lot about it. From what I understand, it relates to a case, and I don't know how connected it is with yourself and the Conjuring 1. So I don't know what you can share about that. Is there any involvement in that at all?
Well, I can shed some light on that for you, dear. excuse me. I have nothing to do with The Conjuring 2. It is based solely as Conjuring, the original film, was based on the case files of Ed and Lorraine Warren. So this is a continuation of sagas that were extracted from their work over four decades as paranormal investigators. And it is, The Conjuring 2 is based on the case of the Enfield poltergeist, which actually had a much more unhappy outcome than our own did. the Warrens went to England sometime after they had done their investigation at our house, which went woefully wrong, and had heard of this case and went to England and became involved at that point. From my understanding is that virtually the same thing happened in that case, that they showed up at our door. You know, anybody that's seen The Conjuring thinks my mother went and beckoned them and begged them to come help us, and they moved in with us. You know, that's all fiction. None of that happened. In the same case with the Enfield poltergeist, I have it from what I consider the most ultimately reliable source of all, that they just showed up at the door. And I know that they were there, and I know that they were involved to some extent, because I've seen photographs of them, you know, original photographs of them with the family. So apparently after they visited the house and Lorraine intuited what she could from that venue, they wrote about it and lectured about it, and it became their case files. And because it is a relatively famous case, a very good documentary was made about it for the BBC, which is relatively easy to find. So it really is just a continuation of their stories and their interaction with the family. And from what I've seen, it is just as, I've got to choose my words carefully here, so as not to offend anyone ever, but it's just as, it's not an accurate portrayal of what actually happened, because of course Hollywood got their hands on it, and that's what they do. In fact, I refer to them as Holly Weird, because they think that it's the industry, it's the film industry. You know, Jason, I know you know, Sherry knows that there are real cases out there and real investigations which occur and real evidence that is collected, and you know, and then the movie industry gets involved, and apparently it's not either not scary enough, or in our case, it was too scary. And so they change things, they alter things, they take liberty and license, and they call it creative license, but actually what it truly is a twisting of the story. And so it's, I've talked to you both about this in the past. There isn't a single scene from my trilogy of books, House of Darkness, House of Light, not one scene from 1,500 pages that appears in The Conjuring. Not one.
Not one, no.
And, and it wasn't because the screenwriters didn't try. They read the books. They pored over them. They lived according to them, Chad and Carrie Hayes, they lived inside the book for 6 months, and there wasn't a day that didn't pass that my name wasn't on their lips. And yet, in the final analysis, when it all came to fruition and the film was made, it was made the way that it was, because as they tried to integrate our truth into the film, into the screenplay, initially, the brass at Warner Brothers said, nope, this will run people right out of the theaters, tone it down, change this, change that. And so what you got in The Conjuring was rather convoluted, distorted image of what actually occurred with our family, and are left with the impression that the Warrens moved in, that everything was over in a relatively short amount of time, that they basically solved the case, expelled the offending spirit, and everyone lived happily ever after. But the truth of the matter is that we lived in that house for 10 years. The Warrens visited 5 or perhaps 6 times over the course of a year and a half. And it all ended very badly with a seance that went so wrong that it almost cost my mother her life. And my father threw them and their entourage out of the house. Now, Lorraine knows that. Ed knew that. And they were both well aware of the circumstances and how their interaction and engagement with our family ended, which was on a pretty negative note. But you can't put on the title of a film based on a true story and then misrepresent what happened. And it's my job to, in the kindest possible terms, clarify this, because if I don't do it, no one will.
Exactly. Andrea, can I ask you something? So would you say that the seance just kind of blew the doors open with everything? It had a sorted path. So when you're looking at maybe, calling in the spirits like that, that just kind of opened everything up even wider, correct?
Yes, it was. Sherry, it was so bad. I mean, I'm almost 58 years old, and I can close my eyes and be back there in a split second. It was truly a traumatic moment in my life, and I saw everything that happened. I heard everything that happened that night, and the mediums that they brought with them, which my mother did not know. The Warrens had called sometime that afternoon and asked if they could make the drive in from Monroe, Connecticut, where they lived, to Harrisville, Rhode Island, to the farm. And my mother was very reluctant because she knew my father was coming home from an extended trip and he would be tired. He didn't have any use for them anyway, and wasn't, just didn't respect what they did, and didn't think that it was going to be in any way useful or helpful, didn't really even want to believe what was going on in the house, even though he was through his worst phase of denial at that point. He still didn't want them in any way involved. And so when they showed up, my mother thought it was just going to be the two of them. He was already ticked off that they were coming, and they came with an entourage. So needless to say, that did not go over well. But the medium that they brought with them virtually conjured the spirits. I mean, I think that it is it's spiritual malpractice to go into a house that you already know, we've already documented, is incredibly haunted, and to perform a ritual that for all intents and purposes throws open wide the doors to the netherworld, at which point everyone is invited in so that the culprit and the offending spirit in the house can be identified. That is absolute insanity, and that is what happened. And they did have a priest with them, and he spent a good part of the evening quivering in a corner of the dining room as white as a cotton sheet. And, the cinematographers that had set up all of their state-of-the-art equipment down in the cellar, went back down to retrieve it after this disaster of the seance, and it had been smashed into thousands of pieces. It was there was nothing to salvage. It was irretrievable. And, you know, so you got two grown men weeping in the kitchen, and the audio woman that was there was so shaken and so, her mind was just blown. I'll never forget the look on her face, ever. You know, my father punched Ed Warren out. I cleaned up the blood at 2 o'clock in the morning with a bottle of peroxide, trying to get it out of the wood in the floor of the dining room. So that, you know, there would be one less thing for him to be angry about. It was terrible. Everybody that was present in the house that night saw what happened to my mother. She was clearly the weakest link, and she was the one that was most vulnerable at the table. She was practically catatonic when this seance began because she was absorbing all of the negative energy that was flying out of my father, and he didn't want them there, and he and Ed were fighting, and it was just awful. Now, that's not the kind of representation that a film is going to put out about the Warrens when the film is being made about the Warrens. So, needless to say, it was all quite twisted and warped. When I saw the film initially with Lorraine Warren, she even, you know, she leaned forward and said to me, I didn't tell them that Ed did an exorcism. Ed would never have tried to do an exorcism on his own. We had too much respect for the priests that trained him. He was only trained to assist. He would never, never have done that. I said, honey, I just turned around. He said, it's only a movie. It's just a movie. You know, I mean, she was visibly upset and shaken because that was offensive to her, and she didn't realize that that's where they were going with, because she didn't have any more control over the script than I did. You know, we were both consultants on the film, but, you know, they would listen to what we said, and they would call us and ask questions and, you know, all of those things. But, you know, whatever was integrated into the film was left strictly to their discretion. So, you know, it put us in an awkward position because we were contributors and yet not. And when I went to the set while they were filming in North Carolina, the screenwriters both apologized to me and said they did everything that they could to include, you know, some of the really organic things that happened in our home, and that they were shot down repeatedly because, you know, no movie studio wants to make a film that's so terrifying that people leave the theater. You know, and that's, so I think that's what they presumed would happen.
So for our listeners and viewers, what happened, the ones that didn't read your book yet, what actually, how did you, were you able to control the spirits? Did you do exorcisms? Andrea, what happened to get rid of them, or if you did?
No, they were never rid. Far from it. There was no exorcism in our house. There was just the seance.
Okay.
I hate to say just, as you know, as a precursor, because it was a life-threatening situation for my mother. I mean, she was something horrible, something purely evil, came into that dwelling that night and took her over for a couple of minutes anyway. I won't say that she was possessed, and I won't claim that it was a demon, because I've never seen a demon, and I've not witnessed somebody being possessed, but she was certainly attacked. And in the attack, she was physically harmed, and her chair that she was sitting in levitated at least 2 feet off the floor, and in a fraction of a second, in a split second, she was tossed from the middle of our dining room into the center of our parlor, which was a good 20 feet away. And
wow.
Everyone that was present in that house heard my mother's skull hit the floor, and everyone present in that house thought they had just seen her die.
I understand what
whatever
you're saying.
Whatever it was, Jason, I'm telling you right now, I swear to you, whatever it was that attacked my mom was certainly powerful enough to have claimed her life. It didn't want to kill her. It wanted to make its presence known to the Warrens, to the priests, to the medium, to everyone else that was present in that house. It wanted to make sure that everyone knew how powerful it was.
Wow.
So for the benefit of the listeners that may not be familiar with the story, so that the seance caused the activity to get, it sounds like, a lot more malevolent. Prior to that, what was going on in terms of what kind of paranormal activity you were experiencing?
Well, it was 3 years into our tenure at the farm when the Warrens first came. Actually, closer to four, we moved in. We bought the house in 1970, and the first time that they arrived there, by invitation of Keith Johnson, not my mother. She didn't know who they were when they showed up at the door. But Keith Johnson inexplicably showed up at the house, and to this day, we don't understand how that could have happened, because he thought that my mother had called him, and she said, "No, dear, I never called anyone. I never told anyone what was happening in this house." So that in itself is a divine mystery. But apparently he was somehow supposed to be involved, and someone called him or something called him, and he showed up, and then he told, after having some incredible experiences of his own at the farm that day, he contacted the Warrens on our behalf, and they came the eve before Halloween in October of 1973. So, and then we were completely done. Our relationship with them was severed in the night of the seance in August of 74. And then we lived there another 7 years or 6 years. So there were many, many things that happened in that house that the Warrens were not privy to because they were no longer involved in the case.
And
did that answer your question? Did I
miss
something?
Yeah, it wasn't necessarily – I'm trying to remember because it's been a while since you've been on the show. Was the activity prior to the seance, was it malevolent in nature?
Yes, it was. I mean, there was really a one spirit, not Bathsheba Sherman. I'm not saying she was particularly nice in life or in death, but she was not the one that was tormenting my mother. But Mrs. Warren said that she was. And so, of course, she copped all the blame in the movie. But it wasn't her, the spirit that was going after my mother, who apparently was in some way threatened by my mom's presence in the house and perceived herself to be mistress of the house. Spoke in archaic English that was already out of usage during Bathsheba's lifetime. She was born in 1812 and died in 1885. And, you know, we can only speculate and presume that it was more likely Mrs. Arnold, who had died in the late 1700s by hanging herself in the barn at the age of 93. And the reason that we presume that it's her is because of when she threatened my mother, and there was, you know, disembodied voices and chants and incantations and threats that were issued to my mother to leave the house, the language usage was more appropriate to the 1700s, not the 1800s. So we think that mom had been already physically attacked, let me think, one, two, three, four times or more. Yeah, at least, no, five times. My mother had already been physically attacked five times by the time the seance occurred. And whatever it was that came into my mother that night and attacked her and spoke in a language that does not exist on this planet, in a very ominous, very dark, very threatening tone, was so malevolent that it scared the spirits it silenced them for months afterwards. There was nothing in the house to the extent that we thought that perhaps the seance had actually worked and that the spirits had been expelled. But that was not the case at all. I think they were just as traumatized as we were.
Mm-hmm. It definitely doesn't sound like a nice place to be. I know that that's terrifying. For me personally, I've experienced, you know, paranormal things here and there, but nothing along those lines. And it, as many people know, I'm kind of a skeptic when it comes to, you know, the paranormal and ghosts. But when I hear personal accounts such as yours, you know, where you're seeing things levitate, if I had seen something like that, I probably would not have an ounce of skepticism left in my body.
No, you wouldn't. And I'll tell you, someday I'll have that house back and I will give you a personal tour. And when you're done walking through that farmhouse, Jason, you won't have a skeptical bone in your body. You won't. You will feel it. You will know that everything that I spent 7 years of my life writing down, journaling, in terms of chronicling the events that occurred in that house over the decade that we dwelt there, from the perspective of every member of my family, there will be no question in your mind that it's the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
And as I recall on our last conversation, you were in contact or have been in contact with the people that have been in that house since. Is that correct?
I was friends with the current owner for 28 years prior, and I had utter total access to that farmhouse for 28 years. And then 2 years ago, when the movie opened, she did a complete 180 and, you know, went to all the national press and said, basically, go away, no ghosts here. The Perrin family made it all up. And, you know, she's got to live with that because she knows better than anyone knows what we went through in that house, because there was nothing that I kept from her, nothing. She knew about the books. She knew about the forthcoming film. She was as cooperative and helpful to me as she could have possibly been. She bent over backwards to assist me in terms of the records that she had, giving me photographs to use, giving me permission to use all the video and audio that I had captured of her, going on and on about all the experiences that she and her husband had had at the farm over the years, the decades that they had lived there. She told me that she bought the house because of its reputation. She bought the house because she thought it would be fascinating to live in a haunted house, and then turned around and denied all of it when it got, you know, the white hot spotlight got a little too warm. And, you know, she has to live with that. She knows. She knows the truth. And so it fractured our friendship. I'll never trust her again. I don't ever want to speak with her again. She imposed herself upon my event that I attend every summer, the Ocean State Paracon, which is in Harrisville at the theater. And she came to the event last year, and we were raising money for a good cause for the Wounded Warrior Project. And she came there to cause a scene, and she caused a hell of a scene. And was escorted off of the property. She was physically removed. She wants attention, but then she says she doesn't want attention. She's suing Warner Brothers. 2 weeks before Halloween, she made the rounds of all the morning shows and, you know, showed pictures of the house and talked about the house and then said, nobody come for Halloween. You know, that was all a setup to see if she could get some people to come onto the property so that she could capture it on film so that she'd have some ammunition against Warner Brothers. I mean, it's so crystalline clear to everyone who's looking at this situation. But it has gotten out of hand now. And a few weeks ago, just before The Conjuring 2 opened, one of the local news reporters called her and asked for a comment and if she anticipated that there would be any renewed imposition or trespassers because of the new movie coming out, even though it had nothing to do with the first one. And she was unavailable for comment, but she did refer him to her lawyer and to a so-called private investigator who goes around debunking hauntings. His name is Mr. Nichols. And the reporter for Channel 10 in Providence did a piece that included interviews with the two of them. And what those two men said, whether it was on her behalf, with her tacit approval, I don't know. But what those two men said crossed the border of slander, and it was it prompted action in our family. I've been holding my dad at bay. He's been very angry about this for a couple of years since all of this happened, because she turned like a viper on our family and on me, and I can take care of myself, but don't you dare call my 76-year-old mother a liar when she's already been to hell and back in this life. I will not tolerate it. And I've been trying to deal with this quietly and not so publicly behind the scenes. But Mrs. Sutcliffe has made this patently clear that she's looking for war, and she's got it. And I'm a hell of a spiritual warrior. I don't think she knows what she's taken on, but I have demanded an apology and a retraction from not only her attorney, but the so-called PI, who said incredibly disparaging things about my family and made a psychological diagnosis as if he had a degree in psychiatry, as if he knew us. I don't even know what this man looks like. He's never met anyone in our family. And they have crossed the line, and my father is taking action, and I'm not stopping him this time.
And that kind of leads in. I was going to ask you how things have changed since the movie's come out, and it sounds like there's some negative things going on, but are there a lot of positive things that have changed? Because I know that you're extraordinarily busy and you go to a lot of the paranormal events. Have you, has it been ultimately a good experience for you to get the books out and the movie to come out?
Well, the thing is that anybody that's really serious about the paranormal knows and is certainly, you know, intellectually mature enough to understand that it is only a movie, but that there is some kind of story behind it. All they have to do is Google our name, Perrin, and those books pop right up. And that's where the truth is. You know, the movie got it right in grand sweeping strokes. Good conquers evil, love conquers fear, and the Perrin family had an extraordinary, extreme haunting that they all survived. That's all correct, and that's the impression that the movie leaves. But anybody that's truly interested in the truth will pursue it. And it's right there for everyone to see in these three books, volume 1, 2, and 3 of House of Darkness, House of Light. And it is a true chronicling of the events that occurred. And it begins before we even move to the farm and explains to the readers, introduces the reader to our family as a normal family. But then they get to be transported with us into this incredible portal, cleverly disguised as a farmhouse, and they get to go with us for all intents and purposes and understand how that transition was made between a normal family and a paranormal family. And then volume 3 is about extricating ourselves from the farm, which was very, very painful and very difficult. And then understanding that profound attachments were formed that were lifelong. So the third volume ends after we've already left the farm and we're still dealing with the ramifications of having lived there. So it really encompasses more than a decade, and It is a true spiritual journey. I mean, I'm not saying that there aren't some horrifying elements of the story, but I am saying that it was also a very enlightening spiritual journey. It's not just a series of scary stories, far from it. And in fact, I know of a number of paranormal groups around the country who, as they bring in new initiates into their teams, say, go read this trilogy of books, and then you'll be ready to become a paranormal investigator, because it covers the who, what, when, why, and how paranormal activity exists, the supernatural realm, dealing with multidimensional sight, with the philosophy, the theology, the physics, everything having to do with, no stone left unturned in terms of, I just didn't see the point in just, telling another series of scary stories. I wanted to know more, and I wanted to share with the readers the insights that not only came to our family then, but subsequently occurred to our family as we processed what happened to us over the course of the next 30 years. Now, we moved into that house, bought it in 1970, moved out in 1980, and the first of the books came out in 2011. So it was a long time, and it took us a long time to come to terms with what we've experienced. And in the writing of these books, I discovered some things myself, including the fact that my most sensible, most pragmatic, most grounded, absolutely solid sister, Christine, was the one that was most traumatized. And none of us knew it, because she worked so hard to hide it. She worked so hard to bury her dead. And when it came time to exhume them, they were incredibly close to the surface. And it was a very raw, very visceral, and very difficult thing for Christine to share her personal experiences at the house. And in fact, refused to share them all. And so did Cindy. There are a number of incidents that occurred at the house that were so painful that they didn't make them into the books. But I would say about 98% of all the significant events, manifestations that occurred in the house are recorded in the trilogy.
Well,
Andrea, did they follow you after you moved out?
Yes.
I've wondered about
that.
We've heard that
before. I'll tell you how I know that. Yeah. I'll tell you how I know how before I even had any experiences after leaving the farm in 1980. My mother and father bought a beautiful piece of land and a nice new house down in Cherokee County, Georgia. And my sister Cindy and our family friend Harry had gone down. I was graduating from college at the same time that all of the rest of this was happening, the sale of the farm, the packing, the moving. And so Cindy went down to Georgia first while my mom and dad and my sister Chris were out in Pittsburgh at my college graduation. And she took the horses and got the house ready for us to come on later. After we finished packing and everything was done. So it was about 2 weeks later that we actually, the rest of us, except for Nancy, who stayed behind to stay as a caretaker on the farm until the new owners assumed the house. So in that sense, it fractured our family because we never lived under the same roof together again. When we arrived at the farm in Georgia, it was about 6:30 in the morning. It was first light. It was beautiful, absolutely stunningly beautiful. And the house had floor-to-ceiling front windows. And Cindy had just made a big pot of coffee expecting us because we had driven all night long. And when we pulled into the yard, of that house. I saw Cindy standing in the window, and I saw a full-body apparition standing right behind her. And it, from that moment on, I knew that it wasn't over, that in many respects it had only just begun.
That would be very amazing to see. Do you think that the what spirits, do you have any indication of what spirits might be following you around?
Well, I'll make that answer easy. All of them.
All of them.
All of
even
them.
Even the Bathsheba spirit that was at the house?
Yes. Yes. She's particularly attached to me. And it's because I've been her great defender. You know, the Mrs. Warren, well, you know, to Mrs. Warren's credit, she walked into that household blind, not knowing nothing of the history of the house, and walked in and said, I sense a malignant presence in this house. Her name is Bathsheba. And, you know, my mother was a little shocked because she had done some history on the house, and she had also spoken at great length with who was the current town historian at the time, Mr. McEachern. And he had told her the story of Bathsheba Sherman, but she hadn't shared that with anyone. And so when Mrs. Warren walked in the house and said that, it took her back. But Bathsheba actually never lived at the farm. She was accused of having something nefarious to do with the death of an infant while there. She lived at a house that was, as the crow flies, maybe a mile away from. So we don't know if she was babysitting. We don't know if it was her own child. We don't know a lot of the specifics around this incident. But apparently, according to Mr. McEachern, who was ancient when we met him, and who knew Bathsheba Sherman when he was a boy. She died when he was 10 years old. She died in 1885. He was born in 1875. So he knew a lot from his family growing up about her. She was not well-liked in the community, and there was a great deal of folklore and accusations leveled against her during her life about the death of this infant that apparently died from convulsions after having a needle impaled at the base of its skull. It never went to a trial. There was an inquest in Chepachet, which was at the time the town seat. And this happened, I would say, probably sometime. If she was born in 1812, she was probably in her late teens when this happened, or possibly early 20s. My mother gave all of the information to Mrs. Warren that she had gathered because Lorraine had asked if she could have my mom's historical notebook and all of her notes to make copies of, and my mother never got it back, which remains a point of contention, because my mother has repeatedly asked for her things back. But I guess possession's 9/10 of the law, no pun intended. And I do believe that my mother's things were sold as part of the Warren's case files and sold to a movie producer. So that's very unfortunate, but that's just the way it is, and there's nothing to be done for it. But, of course, Bathsheba copped the blame for everything, and that's why she was made the villainess in The Conjuring. I'm quite certain that it wasn't her, and because, you know, and I don't know if she had anything to do with the death of that child or if it was just a tragic accident, but I was determined to give her the benefit of the doubt, because this woman was haunted in life and in afterlife with these accusations. You know, the rumors and innuendo swirl to this day around her, and so I made a real point of trying to be fair and create some balance in the telling of the story, not just tell what we experienced and what we were told about her and so on and so forth, but to also, for my own part, try to intuit whether or not she was the offending spirit in the house. And I'm not alone in my speculation about that. I don't believe that it was her. I think it's far more likely that it was Mrs. Arnold, because the offending spirit clearly, obviously, had a broken neck. And Bathsheba died of a stroke. She died from paralysis in 1885. She did not hang herself, as it was implied. Well, not implied. It was overt in The Conjuring. That was just literally made up in the mind of screenwriters. They created their own third story by cherry-picking the information that I provided and the information that they got from the case files from the Warren.
It's an amazing story. And I was going to ask you, I thought of a question. Your books, you were saying that a lot of new paranormal investigators should read them because they kind of encompass all aspects mm-hmm. of the paranormal. I was going to ask, I don't want to give away any spoilers or anything, but a lot of people we've had on the show, I've gotten their opinions of what they believe the paranormal is and what they believe is going on. What's your take on why spirits remain and why all this stuff happens? It kind of fascinates me. I'm a skeptic, as many people know, but I'm not totally closed off to it as well. I'm kind of really interested in the bigger picture of things and what people's theories are on why these events happen.
Well, I'll tell you, I feel I'm adamant about one thing, and that is that there are no experts in paranormal, and that includes Hans Holzer, it includes the Warrens, it includes, I am telling you, after the 10 years that we spent in that farm, if we don't know what we were seeing and experiencing, there is nobody on this planet who does. And we're all babes finding our way in the woods. But I can tell you what I think. You know, and I've done a great deal of research and study on this. Not only have I lived it, but I've also really gone deeply into, as I said earlier, you know, all the aspects around it. And the conclusions that I have personally drawn that I do not expect anyone to espouse. They can each come to their own determination based on their own intellectual investigation of it. But my opinion is that we live in a multi-dimensional universe, not a three-dimensional, five-sensory realm and world, and that once there is contact made by spirit, it alters everything. And once you can see interdimensionally, it alters your perspective, it expands your mind, and a human mind expanded cannot contract, and therefore it leaves you more open and exposed and vulnerable to more of the same. I think that the vast majority of, I think that spirits retain their characteristics that they had in human form. I think that we are all essentially spiritual beings, that we are having a mortal experience right now, but that we come from the spiritual realm and we will therefore eventually return to it. So I think that from everything that I've experienced in my life, everything that I've seen and continue to see on a very regular basis indicates to me that we are seeing, those of us who have had these experiences at least, are seeing either dimensions that are existing simultaneously, or we are able to, or spirits are able to garner enough energy to tap into a place where they once lived or it is extraordinary residual energy, or it is tied in with ancient DNA. And I even go so far as to, I think there's a point of correlation and integration between extraterrestrial engagement with humanity and spiritual engagement with humanity. And I have a lot of reasons why I think that, and we'd need to be on the air for another hour for me to just give you a primer in what I have seen, what I've learned over the years, having been involved with both. So we'll leave that for another interview and another time.
We'll definitely have to talk about that, because I've had a lot of pretty interesting UFO experiences, and that's the one thing I'm not a skeptic on, and the reason for that is obviously I've experienced it.
if you spent one night in the farm, in that farmhouse, Jason, you're going to have to give up the skeptic thing pretty soon, honey, because your things are happening for you right now. You're in the midst of your own spiritual ascension right now, and at some point you're going to have to give up the old paradigm and embrace the new, because the more you claim that you don't necessarily believe, the more you are going to be bombarded with evidence to the contrary. So all I'm telling you, my dear, is just simply to prepare yourself.
I think the reason probably in my case is more of a self-preservation reaction. I think if I open myself up to it, then things are going to start to happen. So it's kind of like a safety response. Well, if I don't think about it, you know, everything's just going to be hunky-dory. Because really, I don't want that sort of spiritual drama in my life, you know.
But you are drawn to it. You are inextricably connected to it. You do a paranormal show about it. You don't deny the connection. Just embrace your fear. You're just a fear-based carbon unit, just like everybody else. And I don't say that in a disparaging way.
No,
darling.
No, I know.
You're lovely. I adore you. But, you know, the thing is, at some point, you're allowing your fear to control your mindset about this. And you're not letting fear be used as a tool to protect you. You're actually giving it the reins. And so what I am suggesting to you, and you can do with this what you will, but what I am suggesting to you is that once you embrace the fear, it will dissipate on its own, because you will render it powerless by loving it. If you love your fear and thank it for every time it saved you from yourself and your own bad mortal decision making, and it tapped you on the shoulder and said, don't go there, don't do that, behave, no, no, no. That's the purpose that fear serves. But once you give it power to control your thought process, it runs your life. And the only way to make it go away, to literally render it powerless, is to love it, thank it, and appreciate it for every time that it did save you from yourself. But tell it, you're not the boss of me. Period. And it's over that easily.
True. Very good.
And Sherry's probably thinking to herself that you hit the nail on the head. And I think you have too, because everybody knows that I'm totally a fear-based person. I have a tremendous amount of anxiety. I'm nervous about everything. And I let it ruin my life, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I just need to do a mental affirmation of just accepting things the way they are. And this has turned into like a personal therapy session, but that's okay. There are things that I need to hear because, you know.
Yeah. Well, that was, you know, the thing is, if this interview was supposed to go any other way than this, then that's the way it would have gone. Everything happens for purpose and reason. And this was our evening to discuss your personal proclivity for being terrified by everything. And you're going to stop that now.
Andrea, can I ask you a question? When you were at the farmhouse, wasn't there a day that you were wondering if you were going to make it out alive?
I was never worried for me. And the reason was because I was never attacked in the house. I was never, nothing ever happened to me in that house that scared me or was threatening to me, because they loved me and they knew that I was going to eventually tell their story and try to set the record straight and reveal them to the world. It was all part of the plan. I'm certain of it now. I mean, I was, you know, wallowing in it when it was there, and my fear, my contempt, and my fear was what was happening to my mother. I was terrified for her. I felt terrible about what my sisters were having to deal with. I was angry with my father that he was denying the obvious. You know, I mean, there were a lot of embroiled emotions around all of it, but it wasn't fear for myself, because I knew, and I don't know how I knew, but I knew that they would never hurt me, that I was the favored one. I knew that. And my mother, years later, said, "We moved to that house because of you." And she said that because I was the one that had the experience when I was right on the verge of my 18th birthday, coming home from college and seeing an apparition standing right beside me that everyone else in my family witnessed as well. And she was the spitting image of me as an old woman dressed in clothes from the 1700s. And so I don't know if it was reincarnation. I don't know if it was a doppelganger. I don't know what it was. But all I know is that I looked into my own eyes as an old woman, and I saw nothing but love. And to me, that was my moment of epiphany, my mother's moment of epiphany, that turned everything around for her, was when she saw an entire family sitting in our dining room having dinner at furniture that was not our own, cooking on a fireplace that had been sealed for 100 years, and having a man that was sitting at the table nudge the man beside him and point my mother out, and she was the ghost that he was seeing. He was seeing into the future while she was looking into the past. Hence my theories and my hypothesis about multiple dimensions existing simultaneously.
Wow.
Well, we are just about out of time, so I wanted to give you a minute.
Well, that's not possible.
it goes so fast.
Possible. We've been talking for like 5 minutes.
I know. It's so strange. There's a glitch in the matrix or something.
It is. It's a paradigm shift. Holy shift.
Well, now you got me thinking about quantum theory and quantum mechanics, and now I'm probably just going to start getting online and panicking about multiverses and alternate reality.
I'm going to send you my own personal chill pill. I'm doing it. You just go on Facebook and send me your address, and it's in the mail.
Okay. Hey, I will. I need a chill pill. I need anything to chill.
You did, yes. Well, what you really need to do is look at your proclivity and your fascination with the paranormal and accept it and embrace it wholeheartedly, and stop telling people you're a skeptic, because when you sit on the fence long enough, it leaves a mark, and it's not comfortable. So pick a side and go with it, Jason, because you're a very bright man. And you know the truth in your heart and in your soul. You know the truth, and you're just afraid to accept it, so stop.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what I'm doing, is sitting on the fence, because I do think I have some abilities. I've had some abilities that have been proven in the past, and I just ignore it and kind of put it in the back burner and don't embrace it. But you're right. You know, you can only sit on the fence so long. You got to pick a side.
Yeah. Yeah.
But with that, go ahead.
I just wanted to say one more thing. I just released a new book called In a Flicker that I wrote with George Lopez. It's mind-blowing in an entirely different way, and I would encourage everyone who's interested in, you know, this type of subject matter to please visit our website at inaflickernovel.com and get a copy of the book. It'll change the way you think about everything.
And are you open for, if somebody wanted to contact you? I know you have a Facebook page. You probably have a billion friends and all that. Is there any other way they can contact you if they want to get any information
Facebook's
or anything like that?
The easiest way. I've got 5 pages, but go to my personal page. It's always at 5,000 friends, but they can send me a personal message. It'll get kicked to my other file, and I do check it. So that's the fastest, easiest way to reach me.
Awesome. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on again. We'll have to get you back because I would love to talk more of some of the deeper aspects that we kind of touched the surface of. And I know how busy you are, and I know you took some special time tonight to come on the show. So thank you so much, Andrea. And I'm going to take to heart what you were saying. I'm going to come up with this personal affirmation. And I think you're right. I think it's time to pick a side of the fence instead of just sitting on the fence.
Yeah. It is. It's the brave thing to do, sweetheart. And I know that you're a brave man, so just do it.
All righty.
Thank you, Andrea.
Thank you so much. And I'll come back anytime. Anytime you ask me. I love you both. You're wonderful.
I love you, too.
Great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You have a lovely evening.
You too.
Thank you.
Okay. Good night, dear.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Wow, that was a great interview with Andrea, and I'm serious. I'm thinking about she's absolutely right, sitting on the fence. And you know this, Sherry. You know me, how much a bundle of nerves I am all the time, and anxiety, and it's time to just embrace certain things and get over it, so to speak.
Yes, definitely. I think you're in the phase where you need to just do some soul searching, some, you know, quiet time, and figure out where you want to go with your life. And as you know, Jason, if you ever need help, you can always call me or come on over.
I wish you didn't live so far away.
I don't.
It takes forever to get out of here.
45 minutes, oh my goodness.
But I have to say, your place is really healing out in the country and all that. And I'm smack dab in the city, so.
Well, I got a lot of activity at my house, especially around the water. So I'm pretty happy, you know, just a lot of activity, nature activity anyway. But anyway, we're excited for next week. We're going to have back Ron Fell. He's most people don't know who he is. He's a demonologist and an exorcist. He has over 37 years experience in demonology and exorcism. He has an organization that is worldwide, and he's going to talk about specifically prevention protocols, signs and symptoms of demonic possession, and advice on treatment until help arrives. So we're looking forward to that one for next week. What can we do, and what, you know, just to educate the public and our viewers to see, you know, what we can do to help ourselves or be aware of.
And he's another person that has experienced some terrifying things. In fact, whenever he's on the show, I always get a little nervous, you know. You start talking about exorcism and all those scary things, but very great guest to talk on the show. So I'm excited to talk to him again about those things. And unless you have anything else, I guess we can close the show.
No, pretty much that's about it. We want to thank our viewers and listeners for your participation and your support. We love you, and we want to thank you from the bottoms of our heart. Thank you.
Absolutely. I want to thank everybody for listening tonight, and we'll be back next Sunday at 8 p.m. West Coast time, and check out the Facebook page, Paranormal Horizons on Facebook. And with that, I'll bid everybody adieu, and we'll see you all next week, and hope everybody has an awesome week. Good night, everyone.
Take care.